I'm a firm believer that bifurcation or fragmentation is not a good thing for any growing sport. Well, there may be two entities that have differing objectives. Ideally, they could complement each other, but in hindsight, you've seen it in boxing, racquetball, among other sports, where different entities come in, and what it ends up doing is fragmenting resources up above, the corporate sponsors. Who do we put our money behind?
Carl, welcome to Behind the Paddle.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
Of course. I know we were just talking about this, kind of like our first interactions. And it was back in, I came into the sport end of 2019. And at the time you had Pro Pickleball Media, right?
That's right.
Yeah. I remember seeing you at the California Open, March 2020. And yeah, you actually came up and introduced yourself and said hi, and you somehow knew who I was at the time when it was literally my second or third tournament. And you were like, yeah, and it was like a singles day too. And you're like, yeah, I'm excited to watch you play. And I was just like, yeah, I just thought it was so nice to hear that. And especially from some, like, you know, my second or third tournament, I played the PPA Mesa, which I think was in February. And then yep. I played the California Open after that. I was like, oh, this guy's the man. And from then to now, like, man, to see everything you've done on the sport's really, really cool. And I'm just really excited to have you on the podcast and talk about kind of your journey of from that moment or even before getting into the sport to what you're working on now. But if it's okay, let's start a little bit with your background. I know an engineer by trade and in the semiconductor, supercomputing end of things. And how did you end up in pickleball and what ultimately turned into, you know, some paddle wars and tour wars and all kinds of things?
Well, it's interesting. The point where we met was about 5 years ago, and that's actually the midpoint of my time in the sport. My background, you know, consists of probably four or five discrete careers. And so I did start off as a systems engineer trained at Battelle Memorial Institute, the largest research entity in the U.S. And I ended up, like many of today's pro pickleball players, I abandoned that vocation to take up pro racquetball. And so I moved into that sport during its boom years. I was involved in competing and teaching for some time. Then I moved into general management of a couple of athletic clubs or court clubs. And so I got considerable experience in what to do and what not to do, you know, during that sports boom years, and learned quite a bit and am applying a lot of that to today, what we do in facilities in terms of business planning and that type of thing. From there, I was an entrepreneur for a couple of years. After that, a recovering entrepreneur, and learned a lot. It was a $1 million MBA in terms of what I learned. Again, what to do and what not to do. And then I moved into tech after that. I spent 2.5 decades in technology, a lot of it with Intel. Most of that was abroad. And then following that, I worked with a smaller, still public company based in the UK. My tour of duty started there in Europe, and worked primarily with supercompute companies, as well as renewable energy, robotics, a number of different industries. The type of solutions we were bringing to market were custom built interconnects, so high speed interconnects for HPC, among other things. Great experience. Ended up leaving that entity in 2014, and my wife and I discovered pickleball that year. We were driving by some tennis courts that were being used for pickleball in Sun River, Oregon, asked our hosts what's happening there. And they kind of rolled their eyes as tennis players and said, well, it's pickleball. Yep. And they had a court right next to their condo. We went out, checked out some cheap plastic paddles and a ball, knocked it over the tennis net there and thought we liked it. Came home to our location here in Portland, Oregon. Bought a starter set at Dick's and went out and started knocking a ball over an unused tennis court nearby. We did that for a bit. We didn't really discover any other play here in the Portland area because we headed south. We had a home in Fountain Hills, Arizona, and discovered there a huge club, several hundred people, six dedicated pickleball courts, and we were hooked. That's all we did.
This is heaven.
That winter. it was amazing. And there's some real important points here as well. This was something that my wife and I discovered that we could do together again from a physical outdoor activity. She could no longer play golf or swing a tennis racket because of some wrist issues. And it sucked us in. We were worried coming back to Oregon after the winter ended that we'd find any place to play, only to find a huge community up here that'd been right under our noses all the time. And so we ended up, we went from, you know, new players and active participants to organizers there right away. We got involved in the, let's say on the organizing side, if not the business side of the sport. That year we became ambassadors. We started a club here in Lake Oswego, Oregon, built it up to 600 people, got the city to convert unused tennis courts. And my wife was a key driver behind that. And it was just a fantastic experience for us, the social piece. I really tried to drive it as a club that recognized higher level players and created an environment that was good for them. And it was just a great experience. Did that in parallel with quite a few other things, though, relative to the sport. As with my background and part of that being an entrepreneur, I was looking for business development opportunities. I ended up teaming up with some guys that that essentially were behind the development of the first ELO-driven back-end processing for ratings. This is back in 2016, 2017. What we did is we did the back-end processing of all pickleball tournaments data, which were then presented to USAP for the UTPR at the time, and provided that for several years. But again, we were twice removed from policy making and all of the elements of that. In 2017, I was recruited by the board of the first attempt at a pro tour, the Professional Pickleball Federation. John Gullo funded that. He's now a part of the Hall of Fame.
Yep.
And we ran several events that year. We had a great plan for 2018 in terms of probably tripling the number of events that we'd done in 2017. But we ended up face planting at the end of that year. And it was another lesson learned at the end of the year. But it was a good experience. Gave me a chance to work with quite a few of the pros and get to know some of the top talent of the sport, which was great. And one outcome of that, of course, was we were the first entity to live stream pro pickleball. And so we'd done that across all four of our events. I was a driver behind that and ended up creating a platform after we folded the PPF. I created Pro Pickleball Media and ended up, for the most part, live broadcasting all the pro events up through 2019. And that's where we met at some point in that period. Yeah. That was a great experience. At the end of that, I actually had agreements from both APP and PPA to live stream both of those tours. I think there's a silver lining in the fact that the only one that I ended up doing after that was the first PPA event. And then COVID hit and everything was realigned, of course, afterwards. I could say that I lost the business to ESPN. It makes me feel kind of good.
That's so, right.
But that was, you know, on the business side, you know, involved in quite a few different things. As far as USAP, I became increasingly involved beyond my role as an ambassador, my wife and I's role as ambassadors in 2016. And that was with the formation of the Equipment Evaluation Committee. And this was a volunteer group of people. I was joined by, actually, the founder of that group was John Anderson. He was a chief engineer within the aerospace industry and lent his knowledge to helping create a transition from essentially garage testing to a nationally accredited lab, put in place the test plans, the standards, and all of the principles below, that support our certification program. He was, continued to work in the aerospace industry. So I was more the day-to-day point person in the operation at that time. Justin Maloof, who is still part of EEC, was also part of that team. But just to reinforce the fact that it wasn't one person making the decisions, there was three people evaluating product that came in and helping drive that. That grew, later on in 2020, that grew to a director of equipment standards. In 2022, we added facilities and the role increased to a managing director. And then we added compliance in 2023 to that same function. Now, most of 23 was spent, of course, providing field compliance support to both the APP and PPA, putting in place a scalable program. We ended up testing by the end of the year several thousand paddles, probably just south of 10,000 paddles by the end of the year. And that really formed the basis of what we're doing today. We tested close to 30,000 paddles in the field with a team of trained technicians that support APP events. We'll be doing the US Open this year as well, and likely several of the NPL events. So we're excited about continuing that. There's some things that we're doing in that I'll talk about in terms of what's next. Sure. I'll take a beat there, see if you've got any questions on what got me here.
Well, there's a lot.
quite a bit. And today, my role is Chief Technology Officer, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the projects here shortly.
Yeah. You mentioned the kind of that first Pro Tour, and that you kind of landed on your face a little bit. What happened in that year to make it essentially not be a viable tour at that time?
I think it was early. It was a solid vision that John Gullo had, and I brought to it the structure and ideally the scalability in terms of drawing eyeballs. What we lacked was capital.
Sure.
And so we were short there. We ended up, of course, there was still the standalone event with the Tournament of Champions at the time, which was a signature, one of the big three at that point in time. And then we piggybacked on top of three other existing events with the pro, a layer of pro play. It was a good formula to begin with. But again, being undercapitalized meant we had a very short runway to secure sponsors. And of course, the prospect of launching a Pro Tour was probably just a bit ahead of its time at that point. So there was no major political tussle, like we might see these days. But I think it was just a bit early, really, in hindsight.
Got it. So, and even in 2020, when you had the APP and the PPA kind of kick off, had to be well funded, for the time, because it didn't really have the numbers of amateur players to into the thousands like you see at tournaments now, where you have 1,500 right. players at an event. You needed a longer runway. So that makes total sense. What are you in your current role now? And it sounds like at USAP you've kind of made your way up into the chief technical officer in terms of equipment standards, also facilities, I believe, right? What are your current thoughts on the state of where we're at in pickleball on the pro side of things?
Yeah, great question. If you looked at what USAP did years ago, it was an entity that supported all aspects of the sport, which included open and pro play, at the nationals, for example. Since the formation of both leagues, both APP and PPA, of course, APP being sanctioned, we're actively supporting that effort. PPA at present is not sanctioned. I'm a firm believer that bifurcation or fragmentation is not a good thing for any growing sport. And of course, if you take a step back and you look at Well, there may be two entities that have differing objectives, differing business objectives, overall mission might be different. Ideally, they could complement each other. There could be some way of collaborating. But in hindsight, coming from sports like racquetball, watching what happened there, and then if you're any type of sports fan at all, you've seen it in boxing, racquetball, among other sports, where different entities come in, and what it ends up doing is fragmenting resources up above the corporate sponsors. Who do we put our money behind, right? And which is the better product? And so there are issues with that, that fragmentation, and right now I think there quite possibly could be event fatigue. If you look at from a viewership standpoint, there's something going on every weekend, and I think the platforms being chosen to reach viewers are sort of getting the job done. I don't know if we're actually growing viewership. I don't monitor that very closely since I'm not broadcasting anymore. I would say that should be a key metric. Are the number of eyeballs watching and enjoying the sport increasing? We made an agreement with QVC to broadcast to millions at Nationals last year, and that was a very exciting move for us. Very out of the box thinking, yeah. Right? Not a conventional approach, and I think it had a really positive impact. And I think that really needs to be taken into consideration. How will the APP, how will the PPA continue to grow audiences out there that can appreciate the sport? I will say, I think there's still a missing ingredient in the broadcast and the representation of what I believe to be the sport's strengths, and that's the work around the kitchen. Yeah. When I was broadcasting, I would have a camera in tight to the net, a kitchen cam, I called it. Yeah. And what it would do is capture the precision of a dinking rally. The fact that those dinks are, a couple of millimeters over the net. It would show the rate of speed in a hand battle. That can really only be done with a camera that's in tight and fills up the screen. And so there's some subtleties, I think, that we can build a better product. And some of that is reflected in a bit of the research and development that we're doing on the analytics side. I hope that we have an opportunity to contribute some technical components to improving how the game is understood and enjoyed by viewers in the future.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting perspective, especially from somebody that's responsible for equipment standards. Because there's multiple ways to look at it, right? You have tours playing with different playing formats. Paddles are getting faster, obviously. And you guys are trying to figure out what that line is and make it a standard, so it's a level playing field, which has been a struggle, obviously, as manufacturers try to push the limits. But I do agree with you in terms of, I don't think we necessarily need to, shift the way the game's played. Players are going to get better. Paddles are going to get better, hopefully within reason, so the game doesn't change too much. But I agree. I think capturing the precision on dinks versus going away from dinks and having, that's what we saw in tennis. Like if now guys with a gigantic serve, serve and volley, points are really short. You want long points. I don't think there's nothing exciting about watching shorter points in pickleball. I like the battles at the kitchen, and just, you're right. I think capturing that and showing, one of the arguments is that, like, I heard Andy Roddick say on his podcast that, people want to watch stuff on TV that they know they can't do, which is like a hit 140 mile per hour serve. They don't want to watch something that they feel like they could go to the park and do. And I think you're right. I don't think the broadcast has done a very good job of showing why somebody at home would struggle doing what the pros do. Cause it does just look like, from a far view of a kitchen dink rally, it looks like they're just tapping it over, right? Tapping it over without any kind of graphics or, I think it'd be cool just to see, like, the height over the net and how tight it is each time. where they're making contact from. Just there's a lot that's not being done.
Exactly. And we've started to scratch the surface. We do, we can do post-event analytics. So we've been working with an entity that Versus Analytics, who worked with us at Nationals, for example, and we're looking at integrating their capability in future events, Golden Ticket, and I hope APP as well, where there's a post-match analytics that are done, which grade the quality of attacks. You know, is it red zone, yellow zone, yep, green zone, for example, and what's the outcome? What's the efficacy of that attack? There are components that you brought up there, and that is, and this is some research that I'd done back when I was recording and broadcasting events, and that is the response time, the reaction time required in a shootout. Yeah. And it's a simple matter of counting frames, from a video clip, but you could see that the fastest shootouts might require a quarter of a second response time. Now, if you apply that to other sports, that's the equivalent of receiving the world's fastest first serve or the world's fastest pitch. Now, the difference, of course, is that after that speed up, you've got another one and another one and another one requiring that quarter or a third of a second response time. Yeah. Whereas in the examples of tennis or baseball, that's it. You've got time to recover, and then here comes the next one. Yeah. And so it's helping people understand just the physical and psychological demands and physiological demands of the sport, which can be considerable at your level. And I think that's something that we can do much better at. And that does translate the analytics side to improving the recreational player's game as well, or a lower level 3-0, 3-5 player. If they understand where they're making mistakes or understanding where the strengths of their game are, they can double down on those elements as well. So there's so much that we can advance in terms of the enjoyment and entertainment relative to the sport, but also the strategy. How do I improve what I'm doing? And I'd like to break it down also to stroke mechanics. There's that part of the physiology that we don't understand. And one last piece that is reflected in some of the research that we want to embark on, and that is, what is the impact on physiology of the sport? There are very few other sports that an athlete can enjoy with the frequency that we do, a couple times a week, several times a week, for the duration, 2 to 3 hours a session, and the intensity, anywhere between medium intensity to, at your level, it's going to be high intensity every time you step on the court, right? And so that drives a physiological change that we all look at each other and say, I'm in the best shape of my life because I'm playing this often, but no one's put a finger on what that is. Yeah. And, there have been lightweight studies. Apple did a study some time ago, but I'd like to see some deeper peer-reviewed research done on this that shows, hey, spending 3 hours on the court 3 times a week has this impact to your physiology. That's important for my age group. In your age group as well, and for upcoming athletes, understanding that I think is critical for performance improvement.
Yeah, and I think, there's tons of data points out there. Like, I wear a Whoop, and it sees when I play pickleball. It knows what my heart rate is. It knows kind of the dips. It knows how many calories I burn during it. There's a lot of data points out there currently already. So it doesn't feel like that's too much of a stretch to do the study.
Hey, have you heard of the new Play More app?
No, what is it?
Basically, the Play More app is like a stress-free scheduling app for pickleballers. So I don't know, we've struggled a lot in group text trying to organize play. You'll set it up and somebody will just like the text. And I'm like, does that actually mean you're coming or not?
Yeah, and it's like, you never know how many people you have, like what rating they are. It's kind of annoying.
It can kind of just be a nightmare to try to organize groups because group texts are just not fun. So basically, the Play More app lets you send out invitations. You get an RSVP list. If somebody doesn't show, there's a wait list that will actually like put somebody right into.
No way.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Dang, that's awesome. What's it called?
It's called the Play More app. So you should download it at the App Store, or you can go to getplaymore.com if you want to look at it online.
In terms of, we talked a little bit about where the game's at. I not that I'm not into progressing the game and change. I don't want it to change too much because I think there are unique aspects to the game fundamentally with the return team meaning to have the advantage, pieces like that, right? Where it's, you know, it's not in tennis, the server has the advantage, you're holding serve, and pickleball, it's meant to be the return team so they can get to the kitchen line and make the serve team make their way to the kitchen or earn the point. I think we've started to get away from that a little bit in terms of whatever that percentage used to be in terms of the return team winning the points. Surely it has reduced significantly. I don't know the exact data points on that, but with the bigger serves, with the more powerful paddles, with it being tougher to get to the kitchen line after a return now, based on how strong the serves are, it's gotten closer to what I would guess, you know, maybe the return team has like a 55% chance of winning the point. It feels like it maybe used to be at 65-70, but it feels like it's dropped significantly based on what I see, in the pro game anyways. So based on kind of that context, where do you feel like you guys are in line with keeping the paddles, you know, at the current standard? Do you see it going up a bit, down a bit? Where do you see in terms of like deflection and power?
Yeah, let's not forget spin. I think that's important. Just to complement a point you made there about the serve. The third shot, the percentage of drives have clearly increased over the last few years. A lot of that, I believe, has been enabled by some transitions in the paddle technology, where you are far more confident ripping a ball from the baseline to where it dips just past the cable, right? And it's very difficult to return effectively from there. The odds of a mishit return by the receiving team on that third shot are high. And so unless they're, you know, extremely skilled. And so, you know, we see, I think there's a higher percentage, but we're intuiting that right now. Right. And so we do need to look at the data. This platform that I referenced earlier is a means to do that. And there are some other approaches. Some people are working to do that. It's not yet automated. We're not using AI yet on this, at least at the pro level. And that's a huge step that needs to be taken. On the paddle side, you know, we've taken steps to throttle power. You know, there was I shared with you a graphic that shows the development, a very methodical, very well communicated development of the paddle ball coefficient of restitution test during 2024. And that was a key step toward establishing thresholds and then policy on top of that as well, not only to contain and sunset those paddles that were extraordinarily out of the normal population, the accepted population, but also basically a de-escalation over the next year and a half of paddles being submitted for new certification from this level in 2024 to this level in 2025. Now, will we dial it back in the future after that? It depends on what where the market is. Do we think it's been slowed down enough? We did establish those figures with considerable enrollment and feedback from manufacturers, from pro athletes like you. We got quite a bit of input on this. Is, you know, these paddles feel acceptable. You know, we can face these without feeling A, like there's a safety issue, and B, like there's an undue advantage being delivered by that paddle. And, you know, fortunately, those paddles were still represented next generation design. And by that, I mean thermoformed, you know, essentially a frame within the paddle. So we were pleased that we were able to rule in new technology rather than, you know, drawing a line so low that we had to stick with Gen 1 configurations. Clearly, we want to make sure there's an aperture large enough for innovation and design of new products while still accomplishing that industry-wide goal. It's not just us, right? It's the industry that's looking for this and the market, that there's a threshold of speed in the sport that we want to stay below. And that means that it, you know, remains multi-generational. That means that different skill levels can still occupy the same court without, you know, too much concern. And so I think we've got a good, you know, solid test and policy and application of that policy over time to make that a digestible transition over the next year or so.
Sure. Stone and I have talked about it a lot on our podcast and talked to a bunch of other pro players on the concept as well. And it seems to be, I haven't talked to too many people that would be against this, of kind of dialing the power back and dialing the spin up in terms of creating kind of more unique points, being able to create more angles on the court, having longer points in singles, for example, where you're using, because right now you have the power and you have strong spin too, but you're not able to see kind of really, really sharp angles as much as you would if you crank the spin up and crank the speed down. Was that a conversation piece in terms of where we should go? And what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, so I think you're right. Throttling power accomplishes a couple of things. One is, you know, bringing the length of the rallies up again. It also addresses a as yet undefined concern for safety.
Yeah.
That, you know, there are lingering concerns there. I think this helps address that without, you know, anybody really ever stepping up and saying this is the threshold. You know, my experience, by the way, is that when I'm on, quarter seconds nothing. When I'm off, a third of a second's too fast, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So what's the number, right? But to your point, the development in that area, I think, is going to be critical to. And by that, I mean the testing for spin rate. There's a number of components: coefficient of friction and surface roughness are contributing aspects or attributes of the paddle that contribute to spin. What hasn't been measured in the past is dwell. And of course, that's a huge thing that's measured in table tennis. Until now, we haven't measured that, but we can with the development of the spin rate tests. Now, PPL has developed a spin rate test already, and the UPA has implemented a threshold. We're still in development. We're taking a slightly more sophisticated approach to this, using a dual camera solution with a very sophisticated software platform that provides something called 6 degrees of freedom. So it looks at multiple axes of spin after the ball contacts the paddle. And so it's still in development. Now, the big picture is where do we land on that down the road? And ideally, what we'd like to recommend is that we get together you know, the sharpest minds in the sport to look at this and say, what's important? Is it using a solid ball for the spin rate test, or do we stick with the ball with holes? And by the way, is that ball with holes the current sponsor of the Pro Tour, or who will be the sponsor next year, right? So yeah. those are open questions. You don't really develop a test that has that much fluidity because you need to rely on it. And so what I'd like to do is see a meeting of the greater minds on this without any politics. Yeah. Let's look at how the tests are conducted. What's the best way to do this with the least amount of variation, the greatest amount of repeatability and accuracy. And then with that, then we decide what's the spin rate that keeps the sport exciting and accomplishes those things that you're talking about, where athletes with greater skills can, you know, do a two-handed backhand flick, you know, that does kick off the court. That's exciting to watch. And by the way, couple that with better televising of that or broadcast of that, people really start to get just how much skill is required to do this. And that
and
really ups the...
Yeah.
Exactly. Athleticism and the entertainment value, I think, would increase substantially. And so I agree. I think we can afford greater spin rates. That does enable that rip from the baseline that I talked about before, though. But again, you have to have the skill to do it. And the other thing is that's still 22 feet away from, well, plus seven. So, you know, it's 29 feet away from the receiver. And so there's plenty of time, I think, to respond there. It's not the same as you and me 14 feet apart, knocking the ball back and forth at each other. So I do see potential for that to be a key metered thing to keep the sport exciting. And and there aren't the same concerns for safety relative to that as there are with power.
Yeah.
That was and a long-winded answer, but an important question.
Yeah, and I think with the power, obviously, I can look at it from the pros angle of how it's changed the game on the pro side. But I think even more of the issue is the amateur side, not just in terms of safety, but safety certainly, but also with just the way the game is played. One of the bigger questions that you see from amateurs is how do you beat bangers, right? And why are we warming up with dinks when there's no dinking when we play? And faster paddles lends itself to even less structured play and less strategizing. It's just who can hit through the other person at the amateur level, and that's become much more prevalent at that level, which I think is a net negative for the game in terms of what the game's supposed to be all about. And I know that sounds like a purist traditionalist type viewpoint, but I do think the beauty of the game is strategy and not just who can hit it harder. And I think it's a really, really key aspect that we don't lose moving forward.
Yeah. And there's, of course, the big picture. If you look at how other sports have handled these transitions, and that's what this museum in back of me is really meant to be, is a cautionary tale. Back on the wall, there are two patents back here. One is Howard Head's patent for this first big paddle or big racket here. And then this is a patent for spaghetti string. And so those are inflection points and challenges that other sports have seen that did change that sport specifically. Yeah. Over here, we've got some representation of an original racquetball racket here. And then this is what, that's as large as they got. So they went from basically 70 square inches of string bed to 105. So you can't double, that component, increase by 50% that component and not see a huge change in the sport. And that's what we're really trying to keep an eye on. Where are the boundaries? Where do we put the fences, to maintain the integrity of the sport? And that's job one for us, right? And we believe, still firmly believe, that this is a game of finesse. Clearly an athlete can bring into it a big forehand and hit the ball hard, but that shouldn't be the overriding aspect of the game, the tone of the game. It should include that component of finesse. It's like golf. You've got big hitters off the tee. You've got the finesse of the approach shot, but the precision around the green. Yep. And we'd like to see that continue in this sport. That holistic approach to how the game is played.
Yeah, I love that. And you mentioned earlier, kind of a meeting of the minds. Politics aside, Obviously, pickleball has gone through a lot of transition with tour wars and different organizations. And we've seen, UPA be established, PPL, as you mentioned. Is it possible to leave politics aside to actually bring the minds together to move the sport forward? Because it doesn't feel like we've been able to get to that point just yet.
I agree. Short answer is I hope so. Again, back to my point about fragmentation and the threat to the long-term health of the sport. Many other new sports have gone through this phase in their life cycle and some didn't survive it. I think this sport has legs, and will certainly survive any of these, existing political situations, but, there's no reason not to try to address them now and prevent them from getting worse. And I think, just looking at what you've defined there, the politics behind the introduction of new standards. Well, let me rephrase that, new specifications. It's not really a new standard. A standard is universally accepted, a set of specifications. But the UPA has introduced a new specification. I think that there's a lack of understanding within the organization about what the impact of that is in the manufacturing community. If we look at the industry as a whole, there was a recent study done, market study done, and they placed the value and potential just of the equipment industry at several hundred million, well north of 300, I think, with a ramp toward 700 over time, I believe it was. And that's, of course, awakened global brands, as well as, you know, very innovative product development by startups. But in the context that's frequently used, a description of the sport is the Wild West, I would add that there's a bit of the gold rush right now.
Yeah.
And it's really driving a sense of urgency. It's really a FOMO-driven urgency that we're seeing to secure market segment share. And unfortunately, in some cases, it seems to be at any cost. And so there are questions of integrity now within the manufacturing community that are driving some market compliance and field compliance programs that we're investing in, which hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about. But it's also, we're seeing some of the decisions being made by the UPA that have an extraordinary ripple effect into the manufacturing community and are introducing a level of confusion in the market as well.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean the research that PPL is doing is bad. It's in some cases, it's very sharp what I'm seeing come out of that. But it's the application of that into policy. And I think just in retrospect, it is interesting that the basis of the introduction of this and the formation of UPA is sometimes stated that the USAP was lagging in terms of addressing the engineering in the market. I'd say that that's a extremely inaccurate statement in that the development to address the power paddles started within months of the introduction of the first one. And if you look at the timelines that I've shared with you previously, it was an aggressive development schedule, but we worked to enroll the ecosystem, the industry, and the process, the standards development in terms of what the threshold should be, and then the rollout of policy and the application of that policy over time as well. So it's a very methodical process. In parallel to that, although the statement made by UPA is that their work was driven to address our lack of progress in that area, 1 month prior to the announcement of a president for that organization, that same person was briefed on the work being done by USAP and the development of the PB Core test. And this was in the context of some significant concerns around the launch of a product at that point in time. This was back in April. Since then, it's been plain to see that they've realized that this is challenging. Doing this type of research and rolling out development and rolling out a policy is very challenging. And that's reflected in deadlines that have been moved twice from January 1 to April to September now. And so that reflects a recognition that this is not an easy task to do this. And we've reached out and said, look, we'd like to come together. We'd like to find a common way to test the equipment, and then B, ideally a common set of specifications that all the manufacturers can build to.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to enable a pro-only specification, even spinnier, for example, higher friction, for example, fine, but restrict it to the pro players.
Yeah.
Don't pollute the market with these paddles that are confusing to the consumer, to the players out there, and might actually not be the right type of equipment to put in the hands of an amateur athlete. And so that offer's been there to get together. I think there's a crawl, walk, run approach to this, although time is of the essence. That crawl approach is getting, as I mentioned before, the right minds together to talk about this is the best way to test to ensure repeatability and accuracy and reduce variation. Then the politics will have to be involved at some point to say this is the threshold to ensure a good marketable product if I'm on the broadcast side. And of course, this threshold ideally would also support fair amateur play.
Yeah. And it feels like the main ripple effect here is, on the manufacturers who, if there's two equipment standards, depending on who's buying it, they're going to have to comply with two different standards. So either that means that they go to the lowest common denominator for that, or they build specifically to that standard. So maybe a PPL standard, maybe a USAP standard, which just, again, a lot of these paddle companies already have a lot of SKUs. Now they're having to either, build to the lowest, the lowest common denominator, or build, USAP specific or PPL specific, which it just feels like a level of complexity that's not just difficult for the manufacturer, but also confusing to the end consumer.
Absolutely. And in at the phase that we are in our life cycle, the sport, it is not good. If we were more mature, let's, take a step back and recognize the fact that we're still in early days. And I think doing this so early, really inhibits some of the smaller manufacturers that want to remain competitive. They want to support pro athletes. I think diversity at the pro tier, this is kind of circling way back to your question about the pro tier. I think diversity within the pro tier in terms of sponsors, commercial support is important. So it doesn't just become the tour of, these two or three manufacturers, right? And so the barrier of entry needs to be carefully considered there. And when you start talking about, outside of licensing and sponsorship deals with the entity, running the pro tours, or entities running the pro tours, when you look at fixing an additional barrier in terms of the type of equipment that's used at this stage in our life cycle, I think that's a barrier to growth, frankly.
Yeah. And just to kind of wrap, things up here, if you had, let's just say Carl had a magic wand to wave around in a perfect world, what would the landscape look like in terms of paddles, in terms of facilities? One thing we haven't touched on, which let's actually do that really quickly. You mentioned Gold Rush. And I know you have good experience or a lot of experience on the facilities side of things. And we've seen a ton of franchises come up, Pickleball Kingdom, a bunch of them. And building at a very quick clip too. All over the country, facilities. I met some guy in Dallas who's opening 20 facilities in the DFW area by itself. And again, it does seem like it's coming from this gold rush aspect of, okay, let's just build. At some point, we're probably not even close, maybe in certain locations, but the supply is going to outweigh the demand. And I'm sure it is already in some places. I think location's a big deal here. But what is your thought on the facility side of things in terms of the growth that we've seen over the past few years and where it's going?
I'm both encouraged and concerned. Some of the facilities being built, I believe, and we've seen our first couple of failures already, and that's not a good look for the sport. I came from the racquetball and tennis industry. During the boom years in the late 70s, early 80s, and I was there as we started to shut down racquetball courts and started to see racquetball facilities close by the end of the 80s. In this case, ensuring not only are the facilities built right, and so we've launched a program and have had it in place some time ago, but we're doubling down on the resources to support it around a certification verification program, which recognizes facilities that are built right and are run right as well. Very excited about that program. We just launched a grant program to help support the build out of facilities as well. But to answer your question, I remain encouraged, but concerned that some of the people moving into the sport may not have the business background or have done the diligence necessary to ensure a healthy club. And I think there is a crawl, walk, run approach that could and should be taken in that. And by that, I mean a master plan approach, build out the core of the facility first, prove the business plan, build the market, and then expand from there.
Yeah.
I'm very concerned about the build it and they will come philosophy that generally results in business difficulties in the future. And yeah. So I think there's some things being put in place. We work with an entity called Ground Rule that does feasibility studies, which are third party and independent studies that help an entity acquire debt if they need to. But they're, you know, they come with business plans and the right assessments to ensure that there's a good plan to drive a healthy business afterwards. That has to be done, that type of planning and the franchising rush where, you know, one facility may remain open for 2 years is that the blueprint for a series of other businesses? We'll see. And so you're right. There's a rush to build right now and there is demand in yep. many cases, but there needs to be careful consideration of saturation in some markets where they may end up overbuilding. And that's always a problem. And we've been there before, but it's been decades since it happened. And so people's memories of that may be gone. I still bear the scars of it, you know, from the failures of the entities and clubs in the 80s. And so I think there's clearly opportunity there for the right business plan and the right operating team as well.
Yeah. Let's say we're having this conversation a year from now, in your current role, let's say we're, you know, cheers into a great last 12 months. What would have to have happened in the last 12 months if we're sitting here at this time next year for you to be ecstatic in terms of hitting everything and doing everything that you've wanted to do?
Yeah. Finding alignment with all of the entities. You know, our role is it should remain neutral. Not a fan of exclusive agreements. And so, you know, continuing to drive that with high value add, technology driven platforms, for example, officiating platforms, analytics platforms, things that complement the enjoyment and understanding of the sport, that would be important to me. Ideally, finding, you know, the other entities, finding a way to work together rather than competing for eyeballs, competing for athletes as well, and looking at that more as an evolution player development type approach. There's a lot of money being invested in the sport by the two tours. And like I said, there's still a fragmenting aspect to that. The things that are close to me, or close to my function, include the facilities development and ensuring the right support is there to bring facilities under the tent and work with them not only on the design and development side, but also once the ribbon is cut, programs where we're involved with them and inter-club leagues, things like that. So for me, the three legs, you know, that I drive include equipment, standards, ideally finding harmony in that area, and advancement, launching an ASTM, a set of specifications that basically open source the standards and specifications for people to build to is critical. Facility side, building the team there to provide the right kind of support. The research side, I'm very excited about, you know, being able to invest more time there in terms of our understanding of the sport, the analytics of and relative to skill and strategy, but also on the bio side, understanding what the physiological impact of the sport is on, you know, young athletes like you, on aging athletes like myself, and what that impact is.
I don't call myself young anymore.
Yeah. In increasing our health span, right?
Yeah.
Ideally, you know, we don't have the long taper at the end of our life in terms of health. It's I feel fantastic until I don't. That to me would be a win, you know, if we got together again in a year that we were able to advance the ball in those areas. The other things that we're doing as a governing body are super exciting with community development. USA Pickleball Serves, it's a huge, huge program that we've launched. And there are a few other things that are in the works that, I'd be very excited to provide an update on once they launch.
I love it. Well, maybe we won't wait a year then. We'll revisit this conversation in a few months and see how everything's progressing. But, you know, I was just telling Malin yesterday, I was doing some research through ChatGPT on you and getting kind of the rundown of your whole work history, background, what you did. And it was, I'll send it to you after this. It's absurdly in depth. And you'd probably be pretty curious on what it spit out to me. Just going through it, I was just like, Mom, there's probably no one else in the sport, at least that I've talked to or know of, that's got the background that you do, that's pushing the sport forward in positive ways, inclusive ways, to help it grow in a responsible way, truly. From the grassroots amateur side up to the pro level. So one, thank you for all you're doing in the sport to help grow the sport in a responsible way. And thank you for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Rob. Thanks for the opportunity to do this. And I look forward to seeing you on the court soon.
Yeah. Thank you, Carl.